Accession number 27803, Mr. Vic Stone, Reel 4. Now, we're talking about, we've just come to the end, really, of your time at Yatesbury and the leave that followed it. And then in February 1943, you go to number 16 Preliminary Flying Training School at Finningley. That's just next to Doncaster, isn't it?
That's right, yes.
In Yorkshire. Yeah. Now, so what was happening here? I note that you were a bit nervous about this posting. In your notes. Now, why were you feeling a bit worried? Not nervous, worried anyway.
Well, I wasn't a fully qualified wireless operator, and being posted to... Now, I don't know whether that was preliminary. I think it's actually a Pathfinder force. I'm not sure, but anyway, I put down preliminary. It was a Polish station. Not a lot of English on there, but very, very nice indeed. Wellington Wimpy Bombers is what they were being taught on there. It was a flying training school. These crews would come in from different schools that had been maybe in Canada, Rhodesia. They'd come into this, you could almost call it like a pool. And they would teach them conversion from whatever aircraft they were flying to the aircraft that they would be flying, which at that time would be Wellington's. So it's like a conversion unit for them as well.
Now, what happened there? What happened when you got there? What was your reception like when you arrived? Because, I mean, as you say, it was Polish.
Yes, it was most mixed when I got there. Trying to get through the language barrier was one thing, and it was reasonably late at night when I got there. And eventually did come through, and I found out somebody who could talk and was found bed for the night, had to see the CO in the morning. And he was most surprised. He was expecting two. He'd been told that two people were going to be posted to him, but he didn't expect them to be UT, that's under training aircrew. He'd put in for some more staff because he wanted more staff in what he called the radio section. Well, the radio section, that covered not only flying control and everything to do with flying control, it also covered the telephone exchange, which was operated by WEFs, you see. And he wanted a few more people there. And he asked, I don't know if he asked for two or he was just given two or told he was going to have two. Well, I turned up, but Arthur Goody hadn't arrived. He arrived much later than me. But however, it worked out okay, so... Eventually, it was decided that would we be cooperative and take on the job as telephone operators. So they showed us around the little telephone exchange was, and we thought it was very, very nice. The WAFs seemed very, very nice. They were English, fortunate enough, and. So we said, yes, we would be quite prepared to take on this for the duration we were there. We had no idea how long we would be there for. It was just a preliminary posting until there was space to go back to Yatesbury. And whether it's because the weather was bad, they got behind in training, no idea at all. But we liked it there and we organised there.
So you were just on the... On the telephone exchange, is that?
Yes, just on the telephone exchange.
What were your duties on the telephone exchange? What was it like?
Well, we worked it very well, really, because we used to take it in turns, and I would do, I'd do quite a long turn. I would do from 4 in the afternoon until 8 o'clock the following morning. Now, the next day, the WEFs would decide what they are going to do themselves, but they would be on from 8 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon. Yeah. And then the other fellow would take over again from 4 in the afternoon to 8 in the morning. So it meant we had 2 days off.
Now, what was the telephone exchange like? What was the room you were in? Were you in the... Whereabouts were you physically?
It was quite a busy exchange, but not as busy as an operational exchange. But you see... the telephone exchange is used like a telephone exchange in folds. They've got a terrific exchange, haven't they? And every station had their own exchange. There's always people on the phone during the day, you know, call the guardhouse, call the cookhouse, I want to speak to Wing Commander so-and-so. All messages coming in now all day long. and it was quite busy. At night time it used to slacken down, because at night time there was very little flying at night time, very little going on.
What was the actual exchange like, though? I mean, you know, what sort of room was it in?
It was a concrete building. I suppose it would be about, got to think about this, about 8 foot, 10 foot.
By, it says 12 by 16.
I was going to say about 10 by 12, 10 by 14, something like that, yes.
That's all right. Something
around about. I was trying to visualise it in my eye, and what was in there.
What was
we
it?
We had, well, they had two PBXs, they called them, and they were a big machine, which, very, very, very antiquated. They were very, very big machines, and when somebody phoned in, a little tab would drop down, and it would reveal a small hole, and you picked one cord up. You picked one cord up from the board, and you plugged it into that hole, and you'd ask the person, who did you want? And they would tell you who you wanted, and then you'd pick the other cord up, and you'd plug in whoever they wanted, wing commander, so-and-so. So when you connected those two, they were talking to each other. Do you follow? And when they finished the call, this little flap used to drop down, so you just used to take them out. And you were doing this all day long, you know, in and out, in and out. So very busy, flying around with your hands like this all the time, you know. It was interesting, different calls you used to get. At night time, very, very quiet. There was a bed in there. We used to lay there. Sometimes we'd talk to one of the WAFs on another station and just lay there and go to sleep. And in the morning, she'd ring through and she'd say, you went to sleep on me last night. It was quite humorous, really. But it was quite good. We thoroughly enjoyed it there. And the people there were very nice.
How did you get on with the Poles? That's what I wanted to ask. I mean, could they speak English? Were you able to? I mean, obviously you couldn't speak Polish.
They could speak some English, yes, some broken English. Because bear in mind, you see, they had English people on there. And they needed interpreters for these people, because if they were in, say, flying control, if somebody came in, if a foreign pilot came in, they'd need somebody who can translate, you see. So there's always translators there. Yeah, we got on very, very well. And it's surprising how you can make people understand by different waves of the hand or different things. Improvisation, I think, is the word, isn't it? Yes, yeah.
So, anything else about your time there?
No. We tried to get a flight, but they said no. The CO said he's responsible for you, so if anything happened, you couldn't do that. But, no, that was it. We thoroughly enjoyed our time there.
But no flying for you at all?
No flying there whatsoever, no. We were just there for until we were required back at Yatesbury to continue the course again. You see, when they had bad weather and they couldn't fly, of course, that put every course it put back. So I think I was number 22 course, I'm not sure. But anyway, wherever it was put back perhaps maybe a week, a couple of weeks, 3 weeks. And then as the backlog built up, so the person, whereas normally some might wait a month, somebody may have to wait 2 months or 3 months before they got there, because as the backlog built up, made it much worse for those in the end of the line. And that's why we were sent to there, just to pass time away, really.
One thing, recreations generally, I mean, had you started drinking by then? I noticed reference to the pub there.
No.
Still not drinking?
I hadn't, no. No, I wasn't drinking there. No. When I came home on leave, I used to go and have an odd half pint with my father, but I never used to drink there, strange enough, no.
So, the next thing is, in May 43, you go to the number 2 radio and signal school at Yatesbury.
Back at Yatesbury, that's right, yes. And then we take up more flying here, and more involved work with the radios, with the repairing of radios, servicing of radios.
Are these still old-fashioned?
Yes, they're still old-fashioned ones, yes, 1084s and the 1082s or something they were, I can't remember exactly.
I mean, were you learning, then, I mean, could, were you learning how, I mean, they were valve radios, weren't they?
Yes, they were.
Were you learning, how far were you going into how wireless radios worked, you know? I mean, did you understand how a valve worked? Could you repair things?
Yes, you couldn't repair a valve, you had to replace them, you know, but you had to diagnose faults. If you had a fault, you had to diagnose where it was, you know, throughout the system, as it may be. And I think about four or five valves, I think, they used to have in those.
So you'd have to... were you trained how to find out which one had gone?
Yeah,
although I think
yes,
they just don't light up, do they? I mean,
well, no, that's right, yeah. It was quite elementary in the end, because with those, as you say, nine times out of ten, if the light wasn't on or if they didn't glow, you thought, well, that is the one, and you change it, and lo and behold, it would be the one.
What about other parts of the circuit? There must have been a circuit in there.
Yes, you could get problems within a circuit. You had to learn soldering, you know, how to solder, what to solder, what solder will go with another solder, what metals you can solder and what you can't solder. We also had to, there used to be a motorbike called a JAP, J-A-P, you won't remember that, but no, and they had those engines there, and you had to learn how to service those. If you had problems with those, you know how to service those, because you may need those to charge up a battery to use in your radios. It was quite involved, quite deep, really. I mean, when you think of Morse code, you just think of Morse code. But there were so many other these small things, like the Jap engine, you know, that probably take 2 or 3 days to get to know how to service that, what parts were and what they were for and how they functioned, and how you could utilise them, how you could utilise a battery, and like charging batteries, how to charge batteries, about the electrolyte in a battery, and the specific gravities, and...
So complex. Morse code, you're up to 15 words a minute, you need to get to 20, with a minimum of 18.
So yes, minimum of 18, yes. I think I struggled at 19, to be honest, but I got over the 18. I got over the 18, but I don't think I got to 20 as I can record.
You'd reached your ceiling.
In my mind, I feel that 19 was what I'd got to, yes. But whether I'd sort of slackened off after reaching the target or not, I don't know. It could have been thinking, oh, at least I've got there, I don't have to worry now. I don't really know what it was, but I knew I'd got there. And once I got there, I was so very, very pleased, because when I left Yatesbury, when I went home, then I had my signals badge on my tunic, and that was very nice.
Now, I think it's there you do most of it. It seems to imply that this is where you did your, this second visit, where you did your flying.
Now, yes,
I don't know whether,
yes.
Did you do any flying at all in the first visit?
Very, very little.
Right,
very little.
Okay.
It was,
so this is where you do
it's
most...
It's almost negligible in the first one. It's more or less to get you, to show you the aircraft, to show you... what you've got to carry, where you put it in, when you get in, you've got to sit here, you've got to sit there. It's adapting you, that's the word I was looking for. It's adapting you to the aircraft.
So, and that, but on these flights here, you're sort of doing all this stuff with Q codes and everything else.
That's right, yes.
And anything you remember about any of the flights?
No, nothing special, nothing spectacular, no accidents, no mishaps, no.
And no gunnery training yet, I noticed.
No gunnery training, no.
Was there a final series of tests before they gave you your badge, your wireless operator badge?
No, as I can recall, when I... it should be on there, actually. So on one of those, it should be on there. As I recall, when I left Yatesbury that second time, I was given my Sparks badge, they call it.
Right.
Which you wore on your sleeve, yes. Which I've still got out there now.
Now, so what happens next? What's the next thing that happens?
Now, I think I had a few more days leave from there, I'm not too sure. And then I went on to gunnery school, didn't I, from there, if I remember rightly.
The only thing that's important, you do mention your leave, but you also mentioned that there were some air raids on it during the air. You'd be in the shelter and back on your old duty. Do you remember that?
Yes, on a couple of times I was on leave, we had air raids, but no bombing within our area. In Sendries, yes, we used to get quite a hail of incendiaries around the. They were confined usually to about two or three roads where I lived, which run parallel with each other, and it wasn't too bad because in those days between the houses they used to have alleyways from one street to another street.
So you'd be back on duty in that shelter as a fire watcher again?
If I was on leave, oh yes, if I was on leave I'd go in there and help them out. Oh yes, yes, yeah.
Now the next thing, you were awarded your wireless operator thing on the June 20th, 1943. Is there a nice picture of you in your memoirs?
I'm hoping
to get a copy of these memoirs actually, which we'll either put in the file of the Department of Documents, but people can look for it there. Yeah. Now, in July 1943, you go to Number 3 Air Gunnery School at RAF Mona on the Isle of Anglesey.
Oh, I see. Yes.
Now, what do you remember about that?
What do I remember about that? Very, very interesting again, because gunnery, active, it's quite exciting to get and fire the guns. Yes, when I went there, eventually arriving there, the usual thing happens, you're met and you're shown your quarters. Next day, you don't do an awful lot. Next day, you know, you go and you're shown here and you're shown there and the classrooms. And eventually you start your training.
Now, how did they start you on the training? I mean, you'd had some weapons instruction before, but not a lot. I mean,
you'd be in a classroom and you've got an instructor there with you. He may have a rifle, maybe it's a Lee Enfield or something. You have a rifle, you see, and he'd say, "Well, now this is," and he'd explain what the rifle is. He'd hold it out in front of him like this on his hands. And he'd say, "Now look, this is a," and whatever it is, you see. Now he'd say, first of all, about security. You must always respect it, he says. Always respect it and never, ever point it at anybody at all. And then he'd say, "Now I'm going to show you how to dismantle this now." And in front of the class, he'd say, "Right, now we take this off," and he'd give you the name of the part and he'd put that down. And he'd say, "This is a sequence in which you dismantle it, and you obviously assemble it in the opposite." And he'd take all these parts out and he'd lay them down, explain what they were, what they for, what they did, until he got to the bare barrel, and he'd show you, and he'd pass it round, and you'd just look at the bare gun, just the barrel and the butt, you know, and he'd say, "Well, have a look around, if you want to know anything, ask about it, about the sights, if you're not sure about the sights." And he'd really go into it very, very deeply. And that was nice because you could hold the gun there and you could keep it in your hands for 5 minutes. He never said, "Come on, hurry up, pass it on." It was just left for you to pass on at your leisure. And then, this may take an hour and a half, sometimes a bit longer, because all the time he's talking, and he's talking about the ammunition that is used in this particular gun. When the gun gets back to him, he would say, "Right, well now we will reassemble it." And he'd say, "That man there, what is this part called?" And he'd hold it up and you had to tell him the name of the part, you know. And he'd say, "Well now, do I assemble that next? And the man would either say yes or no, because if he got the wrong part, he may hold up the wrong part, you see. He may say, "Well, no, I don't assemble that next." And he asked another man, "Now, what do I assemble next?" And this, I thought, was a good thing, because you were actually seeing the part, knowing the part, and naming the part. And that was much better.
So the start was the rifle.
The rifle, yes.
And then
yes.
They move on to what, the loose gun? Or?
No, I think from there we went on to the hand grenade. Yes, the hand grenade.
That seems an unusual thing for you to do. Why the hand grenade?
Well, as I think, I'm not over sure about this. It may not have been the next thing. It could have been a bit later, but In my mind, for some unknown reason, I thought the hand grenade.
Now, why were you actually shooting? Was this just stripping the rifle and hand grenades, or were you actually learning how to use to fire them and throw them?
You were taken on a range, and you were taught how to how to throw them, pull the pin out, and you know, hold it and throw it, and you were taught all this. And also, every time you were taught all the safety factors, what you must do and what you must do, and that was always emphasised very, very much indeed.
Now, so that's the first stage, and then you're introduced to the Browning .303 machine gun.
Yes,
that's going to be the main weapon. Now, what was your first impression of the Browning? What was it that like to strip?
It was. First impression was it is a big gun. It wasn't really, but it was in our day for what it was, you know. That was a bit more difficult to strip. It was heavier, obviously. I wouldn't say it had more parts. Maybe it did have more parts. Very hard to. I'm trying to visualise this at the moment, but. It was a very interesting gun. In effect, it had been well and truly tried and tested over years, and always used in the turrets. Yes.
Now, what were its features as a gun? I'm not talking about firing it yet. I'm talking about this is about stripping it. I mean, was it at this stage to show you how to clear stoppages and things?
Oh yes. If you had stoppages, they could tell you. You could get a stoppage, which could be so and so and so and so and so and so. They could explain it to you. They would try to put the gun in a position where you've got a stoppage and try to explain how to get out of the stoppage. Also, they'd have to explain this with the ammunition as well, because you could get a stoppage in the ammunition belts apart from the gun. And where you may think it's the gun, it's not necessarily the gun, it's the ammunition belt. Yes.
So you're doing that and stripping it down, clearing stoppages. Yes, now, what about the different types of ammunition? You were introduced to that there, because people aren't aware that there's lots of different types of ammunition, aren't there?
Yes. They introduce you to the different types that you used.
And what types were there that you can remember?
The normal ones were the ordinary 303 ammunition. With those, they put tracers in there sometimes, a tracer one. Wouldn't be everyone, but maybe, I don't know, not using the guns professionally. I don't really know how many it'd be, maybe a half dozen, maybe a dozen. Perhaps every 12th one would be a tracer, so as you could see, because every 12th one doesn't, it sounds a lot, but it's not really when you're firing, because they're firing so quickly, aren't they, you see. But it gives you an idea where your bullets are going, you see.
So there's tracer.
And then there's the armour-piercing. I think they were green. I think the armour-piercing ones were green, if I remember rightly. Yes, the red with tracers, yes. And then there's the ordinary ones, yes. Yes.
And that's about it for the time?
That's about, yes.
Now, so this is on the ground. This is all groundwork.
That is all groundwork, yes.
And this looks like it takes 4 weeks. Anything else in the theory, or well, it's not. It's practical in theory, but it's on the ground.
No, not that I can think of. No, you go to the ranges for the grenade. You went to the. No, we didn't fire him in the turrets, not until we was in the air, no.
You didn't ever go on the ground turrets?
No, we didn't have ground turrets there, so as far as I can remember. If there were, I certainly didn't use them, no.
What aircraft were they using?
We used to have to do skeet shoot. We called it skeet shoot in those days. They called it clay pigeon, I think.
Tell us about that, because I never knew about this until recently. I know what it is, but can you tell us why you did clay pigeon shooting?
I suppose the answer I could give is part of the course, but that doesn't give you the answer, does it? No. It was on the agenda, so therefore we had to do it. But we'd be taken out onto the course, and they had these, they used to call them skeets, they're like saucers, you see, and they're made of clay. And they were as a machine, And you put this on the machine, and you pulled it back on a spring. It pulled it back here, and it was obviously a lock on there. And then somebody, you didn't do this yourself, but somebody used to pull it, and you were behind, not a screen, like a mound of earth or something, and you were watching, you know, and then you'd shout out, pull, and then he would pull that, and then your saucer would go, and then you'd follow it and fire at it. And the idea was to hit them. I don't know how many.
And this was shotguns, is it?
This was rifles, yes.
Now, were you taught, is this part of teaching you deflection shooting? Because if you aim at the, if you aim at it, you'll miss it. You have to aim in front of it.
Well, yeah, this is it, yes. So in the lead up to this, you're told about this. When I mentioned the skeet gun, it just came to mind, actually, you see that. But you are taught, and when you're there, you know, you're taken to the range, and they show you, they say, now, this is the firing, I forget what they call it, they've got a name for it. Anyway, they put the skeet on here, and you will be over there, you'll have your gun. And when you see it, don't just aim at it where you see it, aim where it's going, I'd say, you know, but not too far ahead. And that was quite interesting. I suppose you probably had about 40 or 50 goes, which was quite a number in those days.
Did you get the hang of it?
I think I got about 4 or 5 in the end. I don't know. I think about third. I got the third one. I couldn't believe that. Of course, you say pull, and then you've got to be very, very quick. You know, you've got to have your rifle just right, and you've got to have your finger just right, and everything just right before you say pull. If you say pull and you're not quite right, then you've lost it, haven't you? that was very interesting. Yeah.
Now, had you learned the theory of deflection shooting and the use of sights before you went up? You know, because
when you had the rifle, you were taught with a rifle, you had to fire a rifle. Yes, the sights was most important. You set your sights.
What about
the distance?
Did they introduce you to the sort of sights you'd be using on a Browning? I mean, you weren't going to use them.
No,
I mean, you weren't. You're a wireless operator in the air.
No, not on the Browning. On the ordinary rifle, yes, but not on the Browning. No.